And Paul is coming up to the northeast on his sellout tour. He's coming up to Newcastle at the Stand on the 14th of April. He's coming to Darlington Hippodrome on the 16th of April and to Barnard Castle at the Witham on the 18th of April. We are so, so pleased to have him on the show. Please welcome the brilliant Paul Sinner. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Darren. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here with us on the show. It's an absolute pleasure. I'm feeling a little bit starstruck, so we'll just plow through.
I feel very much the same. Don't you worry about that. I feel very much the same.
Now, you've talked lots about your health in recent years, Paul. I just want to start off by asking, how are you doing?
Yeah, all right. Every day's a challenge, but that's the same for everybody, whether you're unwell or not, isn't it? Every day's a challenge.
Yeah.
The disaster years of 2020 and 21 with the lockdown and COVID and everything, it taught us that we're all struggling in our own way, and we all have complicated lives that are often made complicated by real life.
Yeah.
And yeah, you take each day as it comes. I never stop being cheerful and optimistic.
Brilliant. As we said, you're coming back up to the northeast with a couple of shows in Newcastle, Darlington and Barnard Castle. This is all part of a big tour that started last summer in Edinburgh, didn't it? How has the show evolved over the months, Paul?
Well, it was quite a... I make the mistake of writing a show that's very much of its time for every Edinburgh in August. And then things change and things happen, and some people that were famous in August aren't as famous as they are now, and you have to change your jokes here and there. But fundamentally, it's a bit of a bold one, this show. It's the complete works. It's my life story. It's a lot of jokes. There's a long thread story about me getting drunk at an award ceremony a couple of years ago and the fallout from that. There's a bit of showbiz gossip. It's quite a gossipy show, and there's lots of jokes, and there's songs, there's music. Ever since I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I decided to take playing the keyboard more seriously.
Right.
As a sort of, and so I started writing songs, which if anyone has ever heard me singing before, will be very surprised by, because I can't sing. So the challenge is to make the songs funny, even though you know that you are. I'm no Tim Minchin, was one reviewer.
Oh, nice. Lovely.
And I was like, no, I'm not trying to be. That man's a genius, and I'm someone who can barely hold a note. But I think it works. The reviews of the show were excellent last year. Brilliant. And you've got to take that as a good sign.
And
it's a very gossipy, and it's very no holds barred, and it's a very adult show.
Fabulous. And what's your writing process like for putting a show like this together, Paul? Do you lock yourself away? Is it a collaborative thing? Do you do it in the middle of doing other things? How does it work for you?
It's more random than that. I wish it was more organised than you're making it sound. But it's very much you think of a really good idea on a car journey in the passenger seat or on a train.
Yeah.
And then you forget about the idea for 2 days, and then it comes back to you in a dream that reminds you that you were meant to look at that idea. It's quite a random process. And like a lot of things in life, it's very much dictated by deadlines.
Yeah.
Say you got a first Edinburgh preview on July the 1st. Normally on June the 29th, you've got nothing. And on June the 30th, you've got a whole show.
Yeah.
People work to fit to get into the deadline as narrowly as possible.
Yeah.
And so mine is a far more random and disorganized process, where I hope everything comes together on the day. And luckily, fingers crossed, thus far it has had a habit of coming together.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, Paul, because your schedule must be absolutely crazy. You've got the chase, you've got to beat the chasers, the tour, and everything else, all your other quizzing things as well. How do you fit everything in?
The answer is you don't. Things fall by the wayside, such as genuine travel. I've not travelled nearly as much as I'd like to have done in the last 2 or 3 years. So just, you know, when you're self-employed, you just work, because you never know when the next work is coming from.
Yeah.
It's not even that. It's like solo comedy shows, solo comedy tours, club comedy, playing like 20, 25 minutes to drunks on a Friday, Saturday night. I'm very much a popular in vogue host for things like the What Tarmac Award for 2023.
Wow.
I'm considered to be a decent awards host in my price bracket. There's all sorts of things, and a variety pack of events going on in my life. And I see it all as the same.
Yeah.
I see it as all as interconnected, in the sense that the quizzing helps my comedy, the comedy helps my quizzing, being on telly helps me have some authority when I'm hosting the What Tarmac Awards. it all sort of connects up to each other. So on my tax return, I just call myself an entertainer and hope that that just covers everything. But it is a very varied and quite a busy schedule.
And the What Tarmac Awards, it sounds very Alan Partridge. Those corporate gigs, I know they pay the bills, but are they good fun to do?
They don't just pay the bills. They enable me to enjoy life a bit more because it means that I don't have to worry about money when it comes to normal comedy club gigs.
Yeah.
I don't need to ask them how much. I don't need to focus on how much I'm getting for the gig because it's not necessarily my biggest payer. But I actually enjoy them.
Right.
It's a very unfashionable thing to say and a very Partridge-esque, as you say, thing to admit. But I like the responsibility of knowing that the smooth running of an award ceremony is very much in your hands. I take the whole art of it very seriously because at the end of the day, it's very easy to sneer. But for the industry, this is the biggest event and the memorable event of the year and the event that they'll be talking about in years to come, that night they won, they finally, after decades of hard work, were recognised by their industry. And for me, the most important thing when you're hosting the awards is to put your ego to one side and make sure that the winners get the biggest round of applause that you can get the audience to give when they walk onto stage.
No, I'm sure they're really fun nights. We're chatting with the wonderful Paul Sinner this morning. We'll chat more right after this. Cat the Tune on the Red, and we're here with Paul Sinner this morning. Paul, thank you so much for being with us. Now, we know, first hitting our screens in 2009, 16 seasons, over nearly 2,500 episodes, 3 million people tune in a day. I've got it on Series Link, just so I don't miss it. There are so many ingredients to what makes The Chase so watchable. It's Brad, it's the chasers, it's the contestants, it's the questions. What is it for you, Paul, that gives it its magic that makes it still so unmissable?
I think You mentioned a lot of things, but I think that the questions don't scare people off, and the questions are also quite skillfully selected. There are a lot of times when the audience knows the answer and the chaser doesn't, and it makes the audience feel clever and good about themselves, because we are called quiz geniuses, and I suppose we're very good at quiz, but we're not geniuses. In the sense that we're all very stupid in other ways, very ignorant in other ways. I can barely tie my shoelaces in the morning, and I don't consider myself a genius at all. I just consider myself somebody who's very good at general knowledge. There are whole areas of life that I'm not very good at all, and these can come up. I mean, I can't remember what colour anything is. I know how to drive a car, but I don't understand any of the actual workings of a car. Sort of real life, real experience knowledge. I think letting the audience into our lives and making them realise that we can be just as fallible as they are on occasion, and making them feel good, is great. But the biggest thing I think really is Bradley. He's the king. He's got the Midas touch when it comes to TV. Everything he does is really good, and the general public love him. He's got this relationship with the general public. Their love is unconditional, because he doesn't overplay it, and he doesn't get smug or big-headed. He loves the audience back, and he's the biggest, ratings warrior we have.
And I love his relationship with you guys as well, with the Chasers. You know, the ribbing, the teasing that he does with you, and he sides with the contestants, obviously. But I think, you know, the relationship on screen between you and the Brad it feels like a really special relationship.
I agree, and I think it's most seen in Sean, with him and Sean. I think him and Sean have this amazingly funny relationship, and that's why the Blooper Show, which was on this week, last Sunday, often has more Bradley and Sean stuff than Bradley and the rest of us, because they really do have a dislike-hate relationship at times. That is built very much on mutual respect, love, and it's a really great relationship. It's a bit Laurel and Hardy at times.
And is it true, I read, that that you Chasers have your own WhatsApp group to help support each other and... you know, particularly if you go on a little bit of a losing run or something like that.
We do have our own WhatsApp group, the contents of which will remain unrevealed.
I'm not prying.
But it's mostly to help, you know, to help ourselves know which way which direction the questions might be turned, and giving advice on areas of knowledge you might otherwise have been ignorant on. You know, they're asking a few questions on Bridgerton this week or something like that, just to make sure that we keep up, because that's the most important thing for me, is to make sure that I don't look like a dinosaur when I'm on telly, and to make sure that I at least know what the young people are watching and listening to.
One of the things I really love on Beat the Chasers is, you know, when there's a lot of you doing the final chase down thing, and if one of you gets a question wrong, the look on the other's faces when one of you gets a question wrong, I mean, the look on your faces are full of pain, but then the way that the others look at each other is, oh, I can't believe you've got that wrong. You take it very seriously, don't you, Paul?
We take the... genuinely, we're slightly misunderstood on this one. It's a look of pain more than a look of anger, because we're trying to be the contestant, and when we're on your own... you've only got you're on your own.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're playing all together, you immediately look towards whoever's buzzed in. And when they get it wrong, you're not genuinely angry. And the reason you're not genuinely angry is we all buzz in and get things wrong. Yeah. But it's part of the game. When we know that we're all, and if you get genuinely angry, you know it's going to be you next.
Yes.
So we're not genuinely angry. We're genuinely pained, because we want to win. We're that competitive, and we want to win every game.
And the Chasers often get criticism, particularly on the charity editions, when you guys win and block the charities from receiving the money. Quite often, you'll see that a lot of the tabloids will report on that, and that must be a tough one, Paul.
Yeah, but it's television, and it would be a fraud if we let them win.
Yeah,
it would actually be a criminal fraud. We are contracted to always try our best. We signed a contract that we will always try our best, and so we always try our best. Yeah. It doesn't give me a great pleasure to catch a team with 1 second to go, even on the non-charity events.
Yeah.
It gives me pride, but not an enormous amount of pleasure. But you're paid to do a job.
Yeah.
And if we always lost the charity games, no one would watch.
Yeah.
Because they'd go, it's a fix. We're always losing.
Yeah.
And so you just got to play your best. And the way television works is that money has a habit of being eventually seeing its way to charity.
Yeah.
It's whichever team wins, it decides which charity that is.
No, I appreciate that. Now, you've mentioned it already, as well as the chase and outside of the chase, you're a big quizzer. That all started in your childhood with encyclopedias and school quiz tournaments, moved on to a near addiction of pub quiz machines, and then a minor midlife crisis took place that made you take things all more seriously. What was that, Paul?
Well, for a start, I must take this opportunity to say that much of this will be found in my forthcoming autobiography, Once in a Lifetime, which is going to be published at the end of June this year.
Excellent. But secondly,
it is just a feeling there was something missing in your life. There was something I used to be quite good at, but I let go. And as a professional comedian, I think people should understand the privilege of having time. A lot of people who work really hard-working, long hours, proper jobs, what are called proper hard-working jobs, they don't have the luxury of spare time.
Yeah.
Professional comedians, no matter how hard you think you're working, you have a luxury that normal people just don't have, which is spare time. Use that wisely. Try and get better at stuff. And that's what I decided to do. I looked stuff up on the internet about how to get better at quizzing and found out that there were these various little mini worlds and mini quiz franchises. And like five-a-side football, I suppose. I always look at quizzing as being like a nerdish version of five-a-side football or village cricket.
Yeah.
Where the difference being that with quizzing, you turn up to a tournament and you're often playing with the best players in the world, yeah. which was a real shock to the system. The very first major quiz that I went to, Kevin Ashman, the mastermind record holder, egghead, multiple world champion, was playing in the tournament. And it was just so weird to be playing in the same tournament. You don't turn up to five-a-side football and find that Jude Bellingham and Harry Kane are there. And quizzing is one where you turn up to any major tournament and you're playing with the best in the world. It can be a very discombobulating experience, but don't take yourself too seriously. It's a very educational experience to learn from the best.
Now, you were ranked sixth in the UK at one point, and you recorded top 10 finishes in the European Quizzing Championships as well. Do you quiz as much as you'd like to, Paul?
Yes, by which I mean there's been... What happens is you quiz, it becomes very much your life, and then you reach a point where you go, actually, maybe I need to take a step back.
Right.
And that step back happened during the pandemic years when everything went online, quizzing went online, and suddenly you could quiz 8, 10, 15 times a week. Quizzing was revolutionized by the pandemic. There was an online revolution, and suddenly people were quizzing more often than is healthy. And so I actually have taken something of a step back and only take part in quizzes that I really, really, really enjoy. As opposed to quizzes for the sake of it.
I see.
And so, yes, in a funny way, I'm now at the point where I'm quizzing exactly as much as I'd like to quiz.
Brilliant. We're chatting with the fabulous Paul Sinner. We'll chat a little bit more about his TV and radio work right after this. I see the light, the sun is stalling, no longer night, but not quite morning, fall into your room, talk until the afternoon. My eyes are bright, but I'm so tired. Daz on the Cat, the Tune and the Red, and we are honoured to be in the presence of showbiz and quizzing and comedy royalty. It's Paul Sinner this morning. Paul, as well as your extensive TV catalogue, your radio work is equally impressive. Just a Minute, The Now Show, Paul Sinner's History Revision, plus a champion of champion on Fighting Talk as well. How much do you enjoy the radio work? I mean, I have a face for radio, but what is it for you that makes it so enjoyable?
It's a different art. It's not quite as high pressured. And you know, this thing about having a face for radio can make you very self-conscious.
Yeah.
If you believe you have a face for radio, it can make you very physically self-conscious on television.
Right.
This is, it's only your voice that matters and what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And it's a completely different art. But also, I've been really, really lucky to have a producer called Ed Morrish who backed me in terms of factual stuff on Radio 4, mm-hmm. History Revision, Perfect Pub Quiz. In a very, very strange night indeed in Berlin in 2015, right. 2016 rather, I won a major award, the Rose d'Or. I won an award that John Cleese and Caitlin Moran also picked up awards the same night. And it was such a weird and surreal experience to be recognised for something that is like the third thing along that I do after quizzing and stand-up comedy. The biggest award I've ever achieved was actually for my radio work. And, you know, when you say I juggle a lot of things, I really do juggle a lot of things because we're recording a new series of Paul Sinner's Pub Quiz this year. We've recorded two episodes already in Bradford. We've got another four episodes to go later on this year. And it's great fun. The idea of creating a radio show from scratch, being the author of something that's uniquely yours, is very different to being on The Chase, where you've got people telling you what you can do, what you can't do. Yes. Television is so much more disciplined and organized than radio. So I love it. Yeah. I don't love it more than anything or less than anything. I love the fact that I'm privileged that my life is a variety pack.
Yeah.
I love that I don't just do the one thing.
And many people will have seen you in Channel 4's Celebrity Gogglebox with your husband, Oliver. We had Bez on the show recently, and he said it's the stuff that they can't include on the show that's the funniest. How much fun is it recording those shows?
I think I ought to point out that I believe Bez and that me and Bez are very, very different people. I imagine that Bez is probably the absolute epitome of the concept of the stuff that you can't show on the show is the funniest. Well, I'm a more sedate human being. I don't think I'm giving off masses for the cutting room floor. But it's enormous fun, and I don't know whether we'll be asked again this year. Who knows? TV has a duty to evolve and move on, and I certainly wouldn't be bitter if I didn't get asked back.
Yeah.
But it was enormous fun to do, and I'm very proud to be part of the family of Gogglebots. It's a very cherished show. And I never used to watch the celebrity ones. I always used to watch the what the quiz people like to call muggles, the normal people. I think there's a great beauty to the show of seeing how the rest of the world sees you.
And I also noticed that you're headlining the Soundwave Festival up here in the Northeast at Seaton Carew in July. We're really excited about this, Paul. It's a big thing for us up in the Northeast, the Soundwave Festival. It's in its second year now. Festival gigs seem to be, to me though, a very different animal to your normal stand-up, aren't they?
Again, depends on the gig, depends on the festival, depends on the height of the ceiling. I mean, if it's in a tent, you've got more chance of surviving with your dignity intact than if your voice is going into the sky. The lower the ceiling, the more chance you have of people understanding what you're saying.
Yeah.
So it depends on the festival. But the people are a bit more drunk at the festival. They're maybe not paying quite as much attention because there's so many other things distracting them, whether it's a good band or a particularly delicious hot dog or whatever. As someone who has an absolute phobia of subpar toilet facilities, I do like performing comedy in festivals. Considering that, I mean, I can't really deal with subpar toilet facilities. as a result, I've not been a huge visitor to music festivals over the years.
Yes.
I'd rather see them in indoor venues.
Yeah.
But that's just me being a southern wuss.
No, no, I'm with you on this one. I think the quality of the toilets makes a massive difference to the whole day. And we've had a couple over here in the northeast recently, and it's I try and go for the VIP toilets. It's worth the investment. All right, Paul. One of the things that I just recently read about you was a set of 50 facts all about you, Paul. So I'm going to need to fact check some of these with you, if that's all right. How about this one? I've been twice thrown out of my own birthday party.
That is true. One was my 30th. The other one was about 2 years later. And I won't go into details, but okay. let's just say that back in the day, I had an inability to pace my drinking well if I was feeling particularly happy.
Right. Okay. You originally wrote the Diana Ross thin and crusty Supreme joke.
That is true. As an open spot comedian back in 1995, it's now considered to be a Peter Kay joke. Yeah. I'm not saying he stole it off me. I'm just saying his writers probably did at some stage. But or the joke became an internet joke. But certainly, when Peter Kay started telling the joke, I started getting a flood of emails from people going, "I know it's your joke because I heard you tell it back in '95," and I was like, "Oh, I'm still telling it now. Maybe I should drop the joke."
You once saw Alex Higgins punch a man.
That is true at St George's Hospital Medical School bar. A legendary incident in the Freshers Week of 1989.
Wow.
The exact details are too lurid to outline on what is still morning radio.
Yes.
But let's just say he was very worse for wear.
Yeah. And this last one, you once crashed a car in at two others because you dropped a Mars bar and you went down to pick it up.
That is what a lot of people of a certain age know me for. The Mitchum, the Mars bar incident of December 1988. Going to my friend Manoj's house in Mitcham with another school friend of mine, Richard, in the seat, dropped a Mars bar, ruthlessly went to pick it up. Next thing I know, I'd crashed into a Honda and a Mercedes that had been innocently parked on the side of the road. Not my finest hour. Not my finest hour.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is a fascinating list. If you do find that on the internet, it's there's some other really, really good ones in there as well. But we need to move on, Paul, because whenever we get some stand-ups on here, we like to do some quick-fire questions at the end. So hopefully we've still got time to squeeze some of these in. So just some quick-fires just to get to know you a little bit more. Who's your best friend in comedy?
It's a guy called Marcus Birdman, who did Britain's Got Talent last year. Mm. We did a four-person show at the Edinburgh Festival in 2001, which also had Mickey Flanagan, the now legendary Mickey Flanagan, headlining every night.
Right,
me, him, Alan Cochrane, and Mickey Flanagan. And we've been busy mates in comedy ever since. It's Marcus Birdman.
Lovely. What's a skill that no one else knows that you're great at?
Playing piano songs just by hearing them.
Oh, wow.
I'm very good at that. Playing pop songs on the piano just by listening to them.
Brilliant. Which film have you seen more than any other?
It's not a very exciting answer, but I'm pretty sure the answer is Die Hard.
Brilliant.
I saw it in the cinema on the first night in I think January 1989 at the Stratemode in South London. It was such a thrilling experience, and I've just seen it again, and I always get new stuff from it.
Yeah.
But the interplay between Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman is just fantastic, and it's such an influential film in the sense that after that, no action movies could ever afford not to be funny as well.
Yeah,
it's just a really, really good film.
What's the best heckle you've ever had, Paul?
Very good question. I've not really thought about what the best heckle. I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you what happened. The funniest one I got was actually in November last year. I was doing a gig on the Hampshire coast. I started talking about my husband and being gay. And this couple just got up and walked out. And I genuinely assumed that they'd had enough of gay talk.
Right.
And I just said, "What are you doing? It's 2023.
Yeah.
And the husband just turned around and said, pointed at his wife, said, "Somebody booked a minicab for the wrong time. They'd actually left because their minicab had arrived," and I was accusing them of being homophobic.
Ouch. What's the best venue you've gigged in?
Oh, the Newcastle Stand. Did I get it right?
Yes, you did. Well done.
Did I say the right thing? Although, to be fair, I was. It is undoubtedly, along with the Glasgow Stand and the Edinburgh Stand, three of the finest places to perform stand-up comedy. But I love it to bits. I'm really excited about going back.
What's the worst audience you've come across?
Banana Cabaret. I know. There's an easy answer to this. This is 2007, Christmas. I was a Christmas gig where I was the final act on at the Comedy Cafe in Shoreditch. And Christmas gigs are bad at the best of times, but especially when there may have been a Colombian element to what's been keeping them awake and alert.
Okay.
And I died so badly that I had to hide in the kitchen while everyone had a fight for about 45 minutes in the venue.
Oh wow!
While I was hiding in the kitchen, so they win by a country mile.
What's on your rider?
I am no Mariah Carey.
Damn it! I thought we'd get an exclusive.
It's a can of Diet Coke and a prawn cocktail sandwich is about as far as it goes.
Rock and roll.
I'm not rock and roll at all. Can of Diet Coke and a prawn cocktail sandwich.
And finally, Paul, what would be your dream lineup on Live at the Apollo? Obviously, you hosting.
Well, it wouldn't be me hosting, that's for sure. I'm not a natural compere. So my dream lineup would be me because I've never done it.
Right.
And a guy called Daniel Kitson, I'm aware of.
Brilliant.
Because he doesn't do stand up on telly at all. Sam Campbell is my favourite comedian at the moment. The guy won the last series of Task Force, Australian guy.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll do Apollo at any stage, any time now. And Mark Silcox, who is a very, very dry middle-aged Asian comedian who does his own version of anti-comedy, where a lot of people that watch it can't quite work out what's going on, but they're still laughing anyway. And I'd love to see him playing the Apollo, because if I'm going to see anybody play this audience that size, it's got to be somebody who, on the surface, doesn't look like he could possibly play an audience that size. So Daniel Kitson, Sam Campbell, and Mark Silcox.
And yourself, of course. Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. And you're much nicer than Jenny was when we had her on the show. I'll say that. Paul's coming up to the Northeast on Sunday, the 14th of April, to the Stand at Newcastle. Also to the Darlington Hippodrome on Tuesday, the 16th. And to Barnard Castle at the Witham on Thursday the 18th, and of course at the Soundwave Festival in July as well. Good luck with the rest of the tour, Paul. We can't wait
Thank
to get
you very much,
back
Darren.
In the
North Thank
East.
You very much. It's been a pleasure.
Have you tried a Palmo yet, by the way?
A Palmo?
Yeah. It's a Northeast delicacy.
I think that's one of the reasons I'm currently in poor health. I blame the Palmos. I absolutely love a Palmo.
Brilliant, brilliant.
It is the food of the gods.
It really is. All the very best, Paul. Lovely to speak to you, and we'll hopefully see you
again
soon.
Thank you very much. Take care, mate.
Smile.